1970. Interview with Deputy Associate Administrator Dr. Werner Van Braun. August 27, 1970.
So-called management monograph, which is, you know, management is a part of the whole history, and yet it's a tricky part, and so we're going to try to focus on some of the decisions and particularly his management concerns, which really ties the whole program together as a cohesive, terrific story. And of course, involved many people and interaction. I thought maybe as a starter, there might be some of the early decisions might sort of help get you in the frame of mind on this thing. You know, Dr. Glennon had a blank check from President Eisenhower to survey the country and pull together all the non-military space capability. And he got shot down in Secretary Brucker's office. In October, he tried to get you and your people to NASA. Brucker called the young whippersnapper. General Fuwell was there, Gavin, as you're probably aware. Can you recall just what your reaction was to, without going into the whole ARPA story and the ballistic missile story, you being the space advocate consistently along with the basic rocket development, which has application in both areas. Really, what was your reaction to the creation of NASA, say, as of July 58 when it was firm? Without going into this Explorer and the Sputnik story, because this is a complex
When I wrote that,
and I think it was an unhappy experience too for the military.
I hope I didn't get these last two mixed up. After I came in there, I forgot which was which. And yours, I hope it has sugar, and yours, I hope it doesn't.
All right.
And if not, I'll get you a fresh cup.
Okay.
Okay.
Do you want me to try whether this is sweet?
Would you try?
There's sugar.
Oh, good.
Well, I remember that when I heard that NASA was to be created, I felt mighty happy. In on the 31st of January, 1958, you know, we
succeeded in January.
We succeeded in putting Explorer 1 into orbit.
Oh, yeah. And you had
of course,
for some of the
was an army project, and NASA was formed when?
Well, the legislation was signed by Eisenhower in July, and
58.
It wasn't until April, you see, that Eisenhower indicated to the Congress that there would be a space age.
April 58.
Right. Yeah. And this is after the ARPA IDY projects had been approved. You see, you had some of the Juno lunar probes, and which NASA was to inherit. So there's an awful lot of history in this time period, institutionally, federally. And of course, you were there in the Army situation. The Jupiter was coming along well, and the Pershing was coming along. And of course, your big thrust, and then, this is another question I had, Project Horizons, you see. That's a very difficult document yet to get in the original sensitive Army format. We have the Stever Committee stuff opened up now, in which you pumped in your vehicular subcommittee a lot of the Project Horizons configurations on the rocket. You know, the Juno 5 comes to the top, and you had this difficult job, which comes through 58 and into 59, of trying to get some upper stages and a payload for the Juno 5. And this is where you went into the York business, and so I know by 59, why NASA probably looked a little better than it did in 58, but you had the whole picture, I think, in your mind. And,
from where I sat,
I don't want to put words in your mouth now.
At that time, it looked a bit as follows. When I read that the president wanted to establish space agency, my first reaction was a very positive one. I my reaction was, well, finally it has been recognized that there is a great challenge, and there's a need to put an organization together that can respond to the challenge. I don't know when it was that the decision was made to build it around NECA, but I think that came a little later.
Well, that
and here again,
March was that.
Yeah, here again,
that wasn't known too broadly.
My
Dryden and Killian had sort of thought about this in November. Dryden had calculated a strategy.
Now, I don't know whether you know it, but I had been a member.
You were on the NACA committee.
One of the NACA committees.
Well, that was a prestigious.
Many, many years before that. In fact, I served with Gilruth. Well, I think as early as 54 or something like that.
All the names people were on this committee.
The aircraft development committee of the old NECA.
Harrison Storms.
Mm-hmm.
It's a who's who of the, the engineers in the business.
Yeah.
Propulsion, rocketry, and,
And for that reason, I had developed a very high respect for Dr. Dryden personally and practically for the entire NECA team.
They were small potatoes, everybody appreciated.
And
the small potatoes.
I felt that the success of putting a space organization together and make it effective within a reasonable period of time depended pretty much on the ingredients that were put in to begin with.
Yes.
And I for one, didn't know of a more competent group to which the whole thing could have been handed in the NECA. I was also fully aware of Dr. Dryden's concern. In fact, we talked about this quite a few times, that maybe with NECA suddenly becoming a development and operational group, which it never was, that some of the character of the old NECA and its ability to really support the aerospace industry, or aircraft industry as it called itself in those days, in far out fields possibly be reduced. In fact, Dr. Dryden, I believe, strongly suspected that with the public appeal that space all of a sudden had, some of the very good talent in NECA would drift away from airplanes and into the new space arena, which is precisely what happened later on. And in fact, we are right now, in 1970, in NASA in a position where we feel we ought to revive some of that old NECA capability again, because the aircraft industry needs it very badly today.
But he did retain the integrity of the research center.
He did.
And
he
that's
the
great contribution.
Yes. I think it was also very typical for Dr. Dryden, who was, of course, really a very revered man throughout NECA, that he proposed to Dr. Glenn, and I'll be your number two man. I mean, he had been the number one man in the NECA all along there. But he figured if he would get into the program development arena himself, that would be a full-time job for him. And while it was this fine congressional rapport and so forth, he could have done a magnificent job. He would probably be more effective in the number two position, where he could really protect the integrity of the old NACA without blocking the road for the new NASA.
Well, his name was offered to the Congress by President Eisenhower. I may have a chance to interview Congressman McCormick in a few weeks. He's retiring, you know. But Dr. Dryden's statement on the man out of the cannon or woman out of the cannon with reference to your
you know, a lot has been made out of that. when I first heard it, I laughed about it because I knew that this was...
He was making a different point that was generally construed as being anti-man spaceflight, which he was.
Yeah.
He was just saying that this would be obviously merely a beginning step in man spaceflight.
Mm-hmm.
We should look to getting a full range program. But from the evidence we have, and I want to put it to Congressman directly, this one statement did make him have the impression of drive, and he was the dynamic person that they viewed in the over-concern they had at his
in all the discussions long before Dryden made that famous statement about the needy being shot out of the cannon. I had talks with him, and he was really clear to him that manned rocket flight was to come. And I think this particular reference, I mean, I suggested at the time to put a capsule on top of a redstone rocket and send it down 200 miles the ocean, by the way, pretty much along the lines of what the first Mercury flight of Alan Shepard really became later on. And Dryden made this remark, sounds to me a little bit like shooting a lady out of a cannon, which, I mean, all of us considered a humorous remark under the circumstance. And but in fact, we had a joke later on about, you know, about the world's first astronaut worked for the Barnes-Bailey circuit. And after having been shot out of the cannon, he finally went to Mr. Bailey and said, Mr. Bailey, that screen is too great. I just can't take it anymore. I quit. Upon Mr. Bailey, he said, I'm sorry to hear that because it's going to be very hard to find a man of your caliber.
That is good as well. That's one of your best ones. Is this rocket runner? No, he said, oh, that's great. Well, I don't want to fish too long on this, but did you at every time, you know, in this unhappy period, one of the things that I will cover in the History of NASA Volume 1 is the Army story in this, you see. First you lose the big missile business of the Air Force, and then in a sense, from the Army point of view, not
missile. Yeah, but wait a minute. Let's look at the real world at that time. We had an Army development program at the time, namely the Jupiter. We knew it was under... It was contested by the Air Force whether we should stay in that business, and later on the Secretary of Defense actually sided with the Air Force and ruled the Army out of the 200-mile business. But pretty much at the same time, ARPA came in and gave us the means to develop what later on became the first stage of the Southern Ice, namely the Southern One, the first stage, the lead engine thing. And all these were hard assignments, well funded with money in the bank, you know? And something that really kept the hungry mouth busy.
Yes.
On the other side of the house was a NASA that was just trying to get a charter established out of an NECA.
Keep it up again.
And it didn't have a big budget, and was still trying to find out what it should really do in the world. And at the same time, it was pretty obvious. And in the one field where we felt strongly, me building big liquid fuel rockets, NASA, or the old NACA, had practically no capability at all. So I think very few people at NASA at that time out there, at the Army, the missile agency, as it was called, had the feeling, for heaven's sake, if we don't join NASA now, we may be missing the bus. Maybe we were even arrogant enough to believe they will need us sooner or later anyway, because without rockets you can't go in outer space, and if we really ought to have a space program, then the rockets would be needed, and we think we're pretty good at the rocket field. And maybe the very fact that the big ranges, the long ranges, have been turned over to the Air Force, and therefore the Air Force is busy with military requirements now, would make us here in the Army an ideal contractor or so to take care of NASA's needs.
Did you ever
I never had a feeling in those days that, by God, he was stuck with the army, and the army has no future, and there's NASA. To take care of NASA's needs.
Did you ever?
I never had a feeling in those days that, by God, he was stuck with the army, and the army has no future, and there's NASA developing across the street, and we may be missing the bus if we don't get on. I never had that feeling.
That's a good way to put it.
No, I thought sooner or later we'd find our role in that thing anyway, the way everything was developing, NASA not having a rocket capability. We haven't been more or less moved out of the military arena, being available, having the facilities. And we know, of course, that that courting on the part of Glennon was going on, and that Secretary Crocker didn't want to lose the capability. But we felt, well, under some arrangement would be found. Maybe we stay Army and do it on a contract for NASA or something.
Well, December 58, at least you were made responsive to that request,
yeah.
Even though...
Yeah.
Which was a workable arrangement in there.
But did you ever go see General Treves to... to see whether maybe the Air Force and you people should get close.
I did talk to Shweta, yes. Yeah. In fact,
your initiative or his? Do you remember?
I think there was some younger Air Force officer in between who suggested.
Colonel Apple.
I don't know who it was, but. This was only after you heard more and more that we will probably come to NASA. But this Air Force officer, whoever he was, a young Air Force officer, suggested to me, so maybe have a little talk to Shriver on the subject. And I remember that I met General Treves at about that time at the Cape, at Cape Kennedy. And I remember that I met General Treves. We went a little bit along the lines of. Well, we've been competing all these years,
well,
but it looks like you won, you know. the long-range business is now all yours, and that we have to look for a new employer somehow. The Army has been ruled out of all this. And it was at this point where Shriver made a very nice and cavalierly remark, really, to me. He said, you know, we've been competing, but maybe in this competition we have developed a pretty healthy respect for your group, and in fact I have the feeling that had you worked for the Air Force rather than for the Army, we could have saved ourselves and the Air Force a lot of trouble, and this kind of in-house capability and a staff that can do things.
Ablation heat sink history will probably never be written.
Huh?
That ablation heat sink history maybe never written.
But I mean, Treves is a pretty broad-minded man.
Always was,
you know. Okay. And I mean, his statement came pretty close to maybe even use these words, to saying the only thing that was ever wrong with you guys was that you worked for the Army and not for me, you know. Right. It sounded a bit like that. Entirely out of our jurisdiction anyway. In other words, neither he nor I could really decide which way things would go. But when I left, he said, well, should I
Dr. Werner von Braun, Deputy Associate Administrator for NASA. August 28, 1970.
I'll detour and turn off the recorder if you want to tell something you don't want to put on paper. I thought really Tom here, with his Apollo management focus, ought to probably try to shoot on five of the basic questions and then see how our time goes. And because there's quite a story here if you come from the beginning here and then the Brainerd Holmes period and then the George Miller period and how the management council works, which I don't know a darn thing about. And of course he has interviewed George Miller and some of the others, but how you and Gilruth and Beavis looked at it is, this was the core management focus of the whole program.
Well, Dr. Von Braun, I'd like to start out asking if there were any management lessons that you learned at Peenemunde that were useful at Marshall. And by that I mean organization or reporting systems, things that were actually, that you could implement from your pre-World War II experience.
Well, I would say that management methods, whether in Germany or in this country, that were used during World War II were probably far more rudimentary than what we're using today. Because when you have a large program that consists of many elements, involves many contractors and many technical elements, each of which must be designed, tested, fabricated, checked out, and so forth. And the ultimate success of your end product that consists of many of these elements is to be on time and on schedule. We have to have some kind of a system to continuously track the progress and identify soft spots and identify them early enough so that some remedial action can be taken before it's too late.
Right.
Now, I think this kind of problem is as old as...
Yes, universal.
Building things. I mean, a guy who built a bridge 100 years ago was pretty much confronted with the same problem. If he wanted to progress with the work, he had to have all the material that was needed for the bridge on time, in the right location, in the right condition, and so forth. Maybe to some extent you can see the same thing about even of the cathedrals that were built in the Middle Ages.
Yes. I have the right people too.
You have to have the right skills, you have to have the material and time. The main difference is probably that the time schedules are shorter. I mean, the cathedral was built over a span of 300 years, and even the job of the chief architect of the cathedral was almost in, was passed on from father to son, or from one man to another, at least over many generations. And the entire piece was so slow that things usually came out on time to take the necessary action. But when you try to crowd a thing as complicated as the lunar landing program with all the development and manufacturing and even research project into a few years, then this whole chain is as strong as the weakest link, and for that reason we had to have much better visibility than ever before. So I would say the difference between the problem as I knew it back in the Peenemunde days and as I knew it in Apollo was probably one of degree. The nature of the problem was similar, but the problem was more complex simply because there were more people, more companies, more elements involved, you just had to keep an eye on a lot more things. And for that reason, the mechanism of management, of oversight of these things was far more demanding. Now, I think the Apollo program utilized a number of managerial inventions of rather recent vintage. For example, the PERT system, P-E-R-T, you know what that is? Was still somewhat experimental, and opinions in industry about the merits of PERT were still quite divided when we adopted that system. And I think the PERT system itself has undoubtedly benefited quite greatly from its application in Apollo, because some of its aspects that had been fooled very strongly turned out to be not really too valuable, where others were very, very good. For example, we distinguished between PERT time and PERT cost.
Yeah.
Now, PERT is essentially a technique which breaks down a complex process, for example, the building of a computer, the design and manufacture, subcomponent testing and so forth, down into a complicated network which ultimately, after everything has flown together, results in the black box sitting on the table ready to be put into the rocket, for instance. And you can clearly see on the PERT chart which steps are necessary for all the subsystems and all the elements of this thing to really get there to the end. And you can make an analysis, for instance, of the critical path, which of these things will in all likelihood turn out to be the pacing path throughout this whole process. And if you feel you have to telescope your schedule, you will first say, well, I first have to look at the critical path. If that is what really determines the total availability time, the total time needed for availability, then you start with your telescoping at the critical path. Now, this PERT time thing worked out very fine and turned out to be a very valuable tool. We had a complementary scheme called PERT cost. And PERT cost was essentially the same idea, not in terms of days or workman hours and this kind of thing, but in terms of dollars. And the idea was that at the end I have to pay so much, I ought to be able to identify every little nook and cranny into which a dollar dropped to support the final availability of that box. The logic was very convincing. We all said, yes, we have to have that. Maybe that'll protect us against overruns and surprises. But I would say, in retrospect, PERT cost did not do what it was supposed to do. And the reason was probably that in addition to the identifiable cost per end item, you have the effects of a delay in an entirely different area or something else. For example, if you begin your final assembly and everybody is there with his part except one, now everybody is waiting on that one slow guy who wasn't there for the party. And everybody runs up a little overrun there because he's just waiting.
The price could double just
very easily. Yeah. And the PERT cost system is based on the assumption that everything remains completely in step, which it sometimes doesn't.
Yes, right.
True.
And do you remember any actual cases in point when this occurred?
It happened all over the place. In almost every single case where you finally had to make up for the lost time again and so forth. And I think my message is that our dream to control costs with a PERT cost system remains pretty much of a dream. We've got to handle the costs through other means. I mean, I'm not saying we just throw up our hands and let the costs run away. I'm not saying that. All I'm saying is that this system didn't turn out to be the magic answer how to invent, how to prevent overruns.
Now, what was the role of SARP? Did it complement?
Yeah, well, SARP charts were used for more general review meetings. The PERT charts are ideal when you analyze a particular segment of the overall program. But when you look at, particularly the interaction of one operation on another, or one delay on another, the SARP chart is more effective. Let me say this. For example, a question comes up, we have to delay a launch 4 weeks. What does that do to the next 3 launches? That is very hard to make visible on the PERT chart. And in SARP you see much more readily what is going on. Or you have the problem, how many, say, Saturn V rockets do we have simultaneously in the assembly building? You can see that on a SARP chart quite readily, what peaks of activity you have in a given area. In PERT, this doesn't come out so well. Crosstalk between problems.
SARP is the big picture.
The big picture, you might say.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Sir, the during 1961 and 62, I believe you reported to Dr. Siemens rather than to Brainerd Holmes. Am I correct in that?
The 61 on the armament.
Not quite. Here's the way it worked. When we became a NASA center, all center directors reported to the associate administrator, who at that time was Dr. Siemens, that's correct. But there was a program office here in Washington for launch vehicles, which was headed at the time by General Ostrander. And General Ostrander was really the man with the money and the tasks. So I reported to Siemens, like every other center director, institutionally, in institutional manners. Ostrander was not concerned with, for example, we had a strike, for instance, or these kind of things.
Who was general manager.
Yeah. An institutional, you see, as a center director, you have two functions. One is the institutional function, the other is the program function. The institutional function means how does it run the facility, and the other is coming up with the product.
Right.
And the product was for General Ostrander.
Right.
We worked on a contract for him, so to speak, and he wanted launch vehicles to come out of this. The centers reported institutionally to Siemens,
right.
But the programs on the Siemens level were given to the program, how do they call it at that time, program, you may call it
Office of Launch Vehicles.
He was director of the Office of Launch Vehicles, I believe.
Office of Manned Space Flight,
right.
The Jeff George Lowe and William Stutz and then John Disher.
There was a very small office for manned space flight, which really looked only at the spacecraft and the astronaut training things and so forth, and at their capsule, as we used to say.
59, George Lowe was the officer.
Yeah. They looked at manned space flight as like an unmanned spacecraft was here, and he was a manned spacecraft, and of course it has to have life support equipment, and a door to get in and out, communications equipment, windows, and the astronauts' requirement for cockpit arrangements for them to be satisfied, and they had training simulators for the men and all this in the training program. But as far as the launch vehicle was concerned, men spaceflight just went to the launch vehicle office, General Ostrander, and asked for a rocket to boost them. Just like unmanned spaceflight went there for their unmanned spacecraft vehicle. That was the way it was organized in the days of the Mercury program, in the beginning of the Gemini program. And only with the announcement of Apollo as a landing objective, a lunar landing objective in this decade, these things changed.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Then Brainerd Holmes was brought in, and he was told, Brainerd, is all yours, put a man on the moon. And he said, well, in order to do that, I surely have to understand exactly what kind of a support organization I can count on in NASA. And if this is the highest priority in NASA, then you better give me what I need. And he identified that he really needed, at that time, two of the centers. But, well, Houston wasn't even in existence at the time.
Not counting the Cape, you see, the Cape.
Yeah, the Cape at that time was still...
Under you, wasn't it?
Well, there was an Air Force operation.
Right.
I mean, the Cape had there was an Air Force general running the Cape, and the Cape, of course, provided launch services for Army, Navy, and Air Force, and when NASA came in, also for NASA. But, for example, both in Mercury and in Gemini,
the Air Force,
the Office of Manned Spaceflight, in charge only really of the spacecraft and the astronauts, and, of course, the flight mission, went to the Air Force and contracted their launch services to the Air Force, and the Air Force really...
That Kennedy history is really a
fire the
history
rocket.
Of an organization now, isn't it?
And, Brainerd Holmes essentially said, I have to control the spacecraft end of it. If I'm to put a man on the moon, I have to control the launch vehicle end of it, and I have to control the launch operations. And then as these things went, Houston was built. Marshall was expanded, and the Cape operations, where the Army Ballistic Missile Agency had a missile firing laboratory attached to the Air Force launching facility of Cape Canaveral, had to be expanded too. NASA bought a tremendous amount of land all the way up to New Smyrna Beach, had to put Complex 39 in there, and very soon a situation arose that the tail would have wagged the dog if all that, these things that went on there had been under the Air Force.
Yes.
And since the Air Force didn't participate in buying the land, this was NASA land to begin with.
Yes.
So NASA at that time made a decision, we shall have our own center.
Yes.
That's a Vegas Davis report.
Yeah.
I remember a discussion on this very subject that I had with Dr. Siemens at the time. He called me in and said, we are confronted with this question now, what are we going to do at the Cape? Well, there are two possibilities. Either we just continue in Apollo, the pattern that we had developed in Mercury and Gemini, namely that we give the Air Force the launch service and contract our launch operations to the Air Force. Or we have to take that on ourselves in NASA. What would you suggest? And I said, now, in the case of Mercury and Gemini, of course, NASA had used rockets that were originally developed for the Air Force, namely the Titan IIs and the Atlas. And there are competent Air Force launch teams and launch facilities available there. The only thing new is really the spacecraft, but the basic Atlas was essentially the same. And, the operations in space, of course, were also relatively simple. The thing went in orbit, all right, but there were no rendezvous maneuvers in orbit or anything like
well,
that.
Well, NASA did control that, though, under the Mercury and Gemini. NASA did control
it. Yeah, there was a Mercury control center at the key.
But the launch was there for it.
And the Air Force gave this, NASA gave this to the Air Force. And they had a Mercury control center there that took over the thing after it went in orbit. But I mean, this was a far cry of what the Houston control center now is and became under Apollo. The question then, after the Apollo program was initiated and we knew that a thing like Saturn V had to be launched from the cave, the question was, shall we continue this under the same pattern? Now look, we have to build Complex 39. There's no land to be bought and all that. Should we just turn everything over to the Air Force and ask the Air Force to do that? And my position at Siemens was that the mode would be a very different one. In the first place, the Air Force never had a hand in developing the Saturn V. This is now a NASA launch vehicle. So there is no existing Air Force capability in that to begin with, as compared to Mercury and Titan, Atlas and Titan and the Mercury and Gemini program. Secondly, these stages will come from three different contractors, because it was pretty clear that to have a prime contractor for the entire Saturn V would have been a politically impossible situation. The industry wanted to participate in this thing, and each and every one of these stages was a very big blob, and so the decision was really made to compete with the stages individually. And that meant that stages will come from different contractors to the Cape. And there was no need, and in fact it wouldn't have been possible to move all these stages, for instance, through Huntsville, because they couldn't be moved on railroad because of tunnel profile limitation. We could have barged them up to Huntsville. We did this with one or two S1Cs actually, getting up the Mississippi and so forth. But if, for example, a contractor would make an S2 stage in California, there was no point in barging this to Huntsville before we move it on to the Key. It was just moving it up the Mississippi and down the Mississippi again. So all these things indicated that probably the stages would go from the contractor through the static test facilities and went directly to the Cape. And so the Cape would have a very important function that never existed in former Air Force. It would be a far more intimate part, shall we say, of the entire Apollo program. And since the launching, the assembly and the final checkout of these things, the spacecraft was pretty much the same thing. The spacecraft units would also go to the Cape directly. Putting everything together and then checking it out was, in a way, the proof of the pudding. And so I raised the question, do you really want to delegate this most critical function of all, namely to make sure that what you're launching there in the orbit is what NASA wants to stick its neck out for? Do you really want to give that most important part away? I think you could contract all other kinds of things to the Air Force, but not that. And I don't know whether I was the only one who expressed that view, but I remember that I expressed it very strongly and made a very specific recommendation to Siemens that NASA established a NASA center at the Cape and make it fly the NASA flag at the Cape, to do this under NASA auspices rather than giving this away. I think the Air Force was greatly interested in doing it.
They really wanted to take on the job, I know. Siemens even seriously considered the...
He very seriously considered the thing.
But not for long, after you talked to him. It wasn't discussed at length about...
No, but I think...
probably had pressure on him to look at it.
Well, you see, it was a pretty obvious question. The Air Force owned the Cape Canaveral facilities, and there was a question of common use of support facilities, for example, and all this. And the question, if NASA goes down there and really establishes its own empire, he knew that you'd probably have to build quite a few things there just in order to be able to operate. I mean, it goes into the little things. You have to have a motor pool. Okay, the Air Force had a motor pool there, maybe, but just expanding the Air Force motor pool, you could do that. And the Air Force operated their motor pool as military drivers. If NASA did it, we had to have either a contractor or a necessary number of civil service billets. These questions arose.
Dr. McGraw, was the role of the Manned Space Flight Management Council any different under Dr. Miller than it was under Brainerd Holmes?
I think the formal structure in that it was chaired by the Associate Administrator for Manned Space Flight, and that there were several, shall we say, systems engineering representatives of the Washington office of Brainerd Holmes, or the Office of Manned Space Flight, in there, and then the three center directors, and that we had additional people in the back of the room who would get come up and give their presentations. That basic scheme was actually introduced by Brainerd Holmes.
December of 61, I think.
Yeah. And George Miller saw quite readily that this was probably a very good way of communicating. It was clear that in a program of this complexity, you had to provide a platform where the key actors in this program have to be given an opportunity to really see what's the overall problem. Where are we weak? Where are we soft? Where do we have to put more resources in and so forth? How goes it? We have to know in Marshall, for instance, where there was any major hold-up in Houston, and they wanted to know how reliable is the rocket that we're going to let our astronauts ride. And,